Last lecture we solved the polar equation, and well, we didn't actually solve it, I just told you what the solution was, and then I guess we used a somewhat circular argument to justify that the azimuthal quantum number is quantized. So I guess that wasn't particularly satisfying, and I had a look on the internet and tried to find a more satisfying reason for why it's quantized, and we'll look at it a little bit here. And we'll see how it goes. So just to remind you what we did last lecture. So I'll write down the polar equation that we solved. So this is when we were looking at the solutions to the hydrogen atom. Which one?
Right.
That is a capital theta, yes. Maybe it's not supposed to be. Do you guys have the old notes there?
Yep.
The notes from... No. Yeah, I didn't bring them. Yeah, maybe it's not supposed to be. Anyway, it'll be correct in the notes that you see. Sorry? Yep, okay. Okay, and I told you that the solution to this was a function called the associated Laguerre function, and then that was written in terms of the Laguerre polynomial. And so this function only makes sense if this L is an integer. And so let's see, yeah, let's see if we can come up with a better way of justifying it.
The series terminates when L is an integer. You get an infinite series, and it terminates when you take L as an integer. Or you could look at it another way, that if you solve the M equation first, you impose the integer condition on M, L depends on M, and you get that. Hence, L should be integer.
So does everyone understand that? Should I
they
go?
Wouldn't believe me even if I...
Should I go over it? Okay, so the argument we're going to use is not about termination of the series, but convergence of the series.
It converges only when
yep.
L is an integer.
So, I mean, at the moment, we haven't even defined a series, so let's go to that first. Okay, so here, when we initially separated the time... independent Schrodinger equation into the radial part and the angular part, we introduced this this constant L times L plus 1. So rather than doing this and anticipating what the result's going to be, let's just call this constant V and not specify what it is at all. Okay, and then we can make some substitutions. Like so. And then we do a whole bunch of algebraic acrobatics, which I won't go through the details here, but they're not relevant to the argument that we're trying to make. And so in the course notes, I'll give you a link to the page that has all of the details of this of these acrobatics. And so then once you rearrange everything, you can write this in terms of a differential equation, which looks like this. So you can see it's a differential equation, but the coefficients are not constant here. So we can't use the standard techniques for solving ODEs that are applicable to constant coefficients. But it turns out that this type of differential equation is known as the associated Laguerre differential equation. And so I guess this explains why the name of the solution is also the associated Laguerre function. Legendre, yeah. Thanks. And so you can express the... So the solution to this thing is well-known in the mathematical literature, and you can express this in terms of a series rather than what we did in the previous lecture where we already wrote it using the Laguerre, the Rodriguez formula. So the known solution... is PLM 1 minus x squared to the power of m on 2. And then we can split it up into two series. And then we can define these coefficients, a2, n, and an, and so forth, in terms of a recursion equation. So a n plus 1 is equal to n plus m And so in order for this series to eventually lead to physical solutions, we require that this series converges. Otherwise, we're going to get functions that blow up. And so it turns out that this particular series only converges when B can be written as this thing that we initially started off with. Now, like, to me, that wasn't obvious, and I guess I haven't had very much time to think about it. But we can try and solve it in the tutorial this afternoon, unless it's obvious to somebody here. Okay, so we'll solve it. So we can see if we can apply some sort of convergence test to this function and come up with this thing. So if you want to do some prep work for the tutorial, you can start thinking about that. Yes.
It's what Sadam said about how the series has to terminate.
Sorry?
It's what Sadam said about how the series has to terminate. Because if you because like you know that n is an integer, so if you just do a quick change of variables and you let n plus m equal l, and then it's pretty obvious that the numerator will vanish when at when n plus m equals l.
All right. And then we've got L here. Does that become L minus 1?
Well, I guess if you just go, if you just look at the top and if you just say that the numerator vanishes when, or so just look when the numerator vanishes and write down the equation.
Hang on a sec. This guy?
No, the formula for an plus 1.
Right. Yep.
Yeah.
So that vanishes when is equal to L plus L1, right?
You said an plus 1, the this would be equal to 0. The term, it would be equal to 0 when you said the numerator equal to 0. So you get B equals n plus m times times n plus m plus 1, and you can set n plus m equal to l,
mm-hmm.
and so you get l times l plus 1.
Okay. Yeah. Does everyone get that? I mean, we can still do it as a tutorial question, so if it's not clear to everybody. But yeah. Okay, so now I just wanted to move on to spin, which we didn't finish talking about in the previous lecture. Okay, so let's think about classical mechanics for a little bit. So in classical mechanics, we have these concepts of orbital angular momentum as well as spin angular momentum. So orbital angular momentum is to do with the orbit of a center of mass around some particular point. And spin angular momentum is to do with the orbit about the center of mass of a particular object. So, for example, the Earth rotating around the sun, that's orbital angular momentum, and the Earth spinning on its north-south axis, that would be spin angular momentum. But in classical mechanics, this distinction is kind of a matter of convenience because the spin of the Earth is really just like the sum of all of the orbital angular momenta of all the rocks and dirt and everything that make up the Earth. But it turns out that in quantum mechanics, this distinction between the two type of angular momenta is very fundamental. It turns out quantum mechanical particles have this intrinsic angular momentum spin that has nothing to do with rotations about a particular point. And then also it has this extrinsic angular momentum, the orbital angular momentum. The algebraic theory of spin is pretty much a copy of the theory of orbital angular momentum. But we're not going, I mean, it's a bit more involved to motivated than the motivations we had for orbital angular momentum in the previous lectures. So I'm just going to give it to you, and I guess you can take it as an axiom or something. Okay, so the fundamental commutation relations are the same as we had yesterday. And because the eigenstates of these operators are not going to be functions, I'm going to jump to using Dirac notation rather than the wave function notation we were using in the previous parts of this course. And so I'm not going to talk about the analogies between wave function formalism and wave vector formalism in Dirac notation. I'm going to assume that you guys are pretty familiar with that. I think Anna covered it in her course, in her algebra course a little bit. And later on in the quantum theory lectures that Joe Emerson's giving, he's going to talk a lot more about how you make the conversion between wave functions and state vectors. We expect that the eigenstates of these angular momenta are going to depend on two quantum numbers, S and MS. And that's because in the orbital angular momentum theory, we had these two quantum numbers, L and ML. And just for convenience, I'm going to drop this subscript S, and it should be obvious what I'm talking about. So we've got S and M. And so I'm going to label the eigenstates like this using bracket notation or Dirac notation. And so using the same algebraic methods as before, we can find the eigenstates of the operators S squared. Or should I say eigenvalues of these operators? Okay, and also we have the lowering and raising operators. And you can see when you act a raising operator on the eigenstate, you get the next eigenstate with quantum number plus one. And since the eigenstates of the spin operators are not going to be spherical harmonics like we had in the orbital angular momentum case, there's no a priori reason to get rid of these half-integer solutions. So we're going to have that S can go from 0, 1/2, 1, 3/2, and so on. And M goes from S in integer steps, minus S in integer steps all the way up to S. And so it turns out that every elementary particle, yes, Jacob?
Have an extra factor of M in there?
Extra factor of M. Yeah, I think there must be a typo. Is it?
Yeah, M times M.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, and it turns out that every elementary particle has a specific and unchanging value of S called the spin of a particular species of particle. So I'll just give you a very incomplete list of particles. And their spins. So for example, a pi meson spin 0 electron spin 1/2. Photon is spin 1. Delta baryon, spin 3/2. Graviton, spin 2. And so on and so on.
Wait, gravitons exist?
You tell me.
Do they have spin 2?
That's outside of the scope of this course. Okay, and so we'll talk a little bit about spin half particles because they're one of the more important particles. They make up all of the particles that make up ordinary matter, so protons, neutrons, electrons, as well as quarks and all other leptons. Okay, so spin half. So for spin half particles, S equals 1/2, and so M is going to equal minus 1/2 and 1/2, which means that we've got two eigenstates that form a basis for any arbitrary state of spin half particle. Okay, so our eigenstates would be 1/2, 1/2, and 1/2 minus 1/2, And since spin is not going to change, we can just stop talking about it for convenience, and we can use this informal notation where this is called a spin half particle, and that's called a spin up particle, and that's called a spin down particle. And so these states form a basis which we can use to write down the operators that we're interested in, as well as the states that we're interested in matrix notation. So in this basis, we can say that the S squared operator is 3 on 2 H bar squared sigma 0, and the other X, Y, and Z components are H bar on 2 sigma I, where we can define sigma 0 to be the identity operator, sigma X looks like that. And these three operators are the famous Pauli operators. And we can also write the raising and lowering operators in this basis. So let's write S plus equals H bar 0, 1, 0, 0, and S minus equals that. And so notice that all of these are Hermitian operators, which means that they're observables, and these are not, so you can't measure them. Okay, so let's now consider some arbitrary state. That's an arbitrary superposition of the spin up and spin down particles. So I'm going to call this psi is equal to alpha up plus beta down. And alpha and beta are complex numbers. And they have to satisfy the, we'll get to that in a sec. But so let's say we want to make a measurement in the SZ basis or the sigma Z basis. The eigenstates of this basis are going to be well, exactly these states, up and down. So we know that if we measure in this basis, we're going to get the result plus H bar on 2 with probability mod alpha squared. And we're going to get the result minus H bar on 2 with probability beta squared. So this is if we measure in the sigma z basis. But what happens if we want to measure along the x-axis, so for the sigma x basis? So to do that, we'd like to write down the eigenstates for sigma, let's write this as SC. So what about SX? Well, the eigenstates for SX are let's call them plus is equal to 1 on square root 2 and an equal superposition of up and down. and then the minus state is also an equal superposition of these two, but we're going to have a different phase with which we're adding these. So now if we want to figure out what the probabilities are, we can just rewrite this state psi in the basis of sigma x. So now psi is equal to alpha plus b beta plus alpha minus beta on root 2 minus. And so now if we measure in this basis, we're going to get the result plus h bar on 2 with probability a half mod alpha plus beta squared, and we're going to get the result minus h bar on 2 with probability half alpha minus beta squared. And since the probabilities have to add up to 1, we're going to have a normalization condition that alpha squared plus beta squared has to be equal to half alpha plus beta squared plus a half alpha minus beta squared, and that has to be equal to 1. Okay. Any questions about that so far? Okay, so now I want to go on to the next section, which is to do with addition of angular momentum. And so you can do this in general, but we're just going to talk about spins here for simplicity. But it's not too difficult to generalize this to all of angular momentum. Okay, so let's write down addition of angular momentum. So if we've got two spins, let's call them S1 and S2, these two particles can combine states with total spin that can range anywhere from, total spin of system can range anywhere from S1 plus S2 all the way to the difference between the two spins in integer steps. So let's call this the total spin S can be S1 plus S2, S1 plus S2, minus 1, S1 plus S2, minus 2, and so on, all the way to the difference between those two. And so the way that you get different values of total spin just depends on, let's say whether you're adding the spins, if they're aligned or anti-aligned or so on. Okay, so then the Z component, total Z component, is going to range, again, all the way from minus S in integer values, in integer steps, all the way to S. Okay, and so we can write down the total state of whatever composite system that you have just in terms of the total quantum number S and the total quantum number m. So now I'm saying that this state represents the state of my combined system, and that's going to be given by a linear superposition of states written in the composite eigenbasis of the original states that you started off with. So this will be a sum over M1 and M2, but only when they add up to M, because only the composite states that contribute, let's get this right, composite states that contribute, because the Z components add, it's only the composite states that add up to M that contribute to this state. And so this linear combination will have a bunch of prefactors. Let's call them C, subscript M1, M2, M, superscript S1, S2, S. And then we've got a tensor product of two states, which are the eigenstates of the initial, of the individual particles. And this also works the other way around. If you wanted to write down one of these states in terms of a linear superposition of the combined angular momentum states, we can write this inversely. Now we're adding over S, and then the same coefficients. Okay, and so these coefficients C, they're called the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients, and we're not going to derive them here, but usually they're presented in terms of these tables. That the first time you see them, they look somewhat horrifying, but they're actually not so bad. Once you figure out what's going on. So I drew some of these over here before we started the lecture. So let's have a look.
Do you mean that sum over S here?
Sum over S. Yes. Yeah, so it'll be clear from the diagrams what that actually means. So I drew two of these diagrams. One of them is for two spin half particles, and the other diagram is for one spin one particle and one spin half particle. And so the way that you read these is that these values here define the eigenbases of the composite system. So this value will be S, that value will be M. Again, S, M, S, M, S, M. And then these values here define the eigenbasis of the composite system. So you can see here that the eigenbasis has actually, you know, four values. But we know that S1 and S2 are just going to be the same. So really, it's just enough to separate the different states, to distinguish the different states just by M1 and M2. So for this particular diagram, here you've got S1 and S2, and then this will be M1 and M2. So M1, M2, M1, M2, M1, M2, M1, M2. And then these values in the middle here are going to be your coefficients, C, subscript, blah, 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 blah. And it's implicit that you want to take the square root of these values. But whenever there's a minus sign, that minus sign goes out the front of the square root. So, but it's a nice compact way of representing all of this. So we'll go through a couple of examples, which will hopefully make this a bit clearer. So if we, let's say we've got two particles, two spin half particles, and we've suppressed the orbital angular momentum, so we don't need to think about that. Then we know that the basis states for this composite system is going to have four states given by these rows here. or sorry, these rows or these columns. So two spin half particles. So S1 equals a half, S2 equals a half. And so we can write down the basis states. Let's write them in the composite basis first. Okay, we're going to have M1 half and M2 half particles. So that's going to be spin up and spin up. So that's one basis state, spin up, spin up. This one will be spin up, spin down. Then we'll have spin down, spin up, and spin down, spin down. So our four states are like this. And so each one, the first ket here represents system A, and the second ket represents system B, and then there's an implicit tensor product between those two things. Let's say we wanted to write down the four basis states of the composite system. We can read them off from there again. So this is now going to be in this sort of notation. So we're going to have 1, 1. So 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, and 1, minus 1. And so I've switched these two around, but I guess you guys know why I've done that, or it'll become evident in a second. And now if I want to actually write down what these basis states are in terms of the basis states of the composite systems, we can just use these coefficients here. So if we're interested in this one, it's going to give us, we're only going to have one state. So it'll be the spin up state. Now, for this guy here, we're going to have a superposition of two states, of this one and that one. And the coefficients at the front are going to be square root of a half and square root of a half. So we can put that out the front. And for this guy, we're only going to have one state. But it's going to have with a coefficient 1. And you can see that they're spin down particles because it's minus a half. And similarly, for this guy, we're going to have a coefficient of 1 on root 2 out the front. And a minus sign. And so that minus sign came from here. Okay. So does that all seem reasonable? I'll just do another one for this case here. I'm not going to write down all the basis states because it's way too many, but I'll just show you an example of what some of these states might look like. So let's say if we're interested in, how about that one? So we're going to have S equals a half and M equals minus a half. So spin 1 and spin half. So that state is going to be a superposition of this state with a coefficient square root of that, and this state with the coefficient of square root of that. like that. And on the tutorial, I'm going to get you guys to do some of the more complicated ones. So have a think about this over the lunch break. What time did I say we're finishing? At 12. Okay. Yep. Yes.
So the coefficients in the table are the squares of the
coefficients. Yes, but there's a funny minus sign thing. So if there's a minus sign, it means you take the square root of the absolute value and put the minus sign out the front.
And
yeah.
So these coefficients, have you calculated them or?
I didn't calculate them. There's a way of calculating them.
But it's not some straightforward way of looking at the table and then calculating the bits.
I mean, do you mean how you derive and come up with the table or given the table had?
Table.
Yeah, I mean, it's relatively straightforward, but it's a bit time consuming, so we're not going to do it here. But I can give you a reference for that, like in the tutorial. But it's to do with coming you construct matrices that take you from this basis to that basis,
okay.
And then the coefficients of these matrices, which are non-unitary matrices.
But it's not something it's obvious that I should be able to see by looking at the table.
The way that it's constructed here, I don't see any obvious pattern.
But
I mean, I guess there's a little bit of a pattern, but
there's one way, like generalizing what we did with just, for example, the L plus and L minus
mm-hmm.
for angular momentum. You can define L plus and L minus for the two particles.
Mm-hmm.
And just by knowing the first one, let's say the one, you can construct the other ones by lowering or and require them, they are normalized and orthonormal to the other
yeah.
ones.
You can do this this as well. But you can write down a general expression for how to calculate all of the coefficients here as well, which I think the method that you're proposing gets quite involved when you've got really big systems.
Yeah, more than two.
Yeah.
Also, like, when you have a symmetric tensor product, like one half, you know that the symmetry has to be, like, the switch of the lower indices has to be preserved. So, like, I guess that's how I remember that the singlet state is the minus sign and the triplet state is the plus sign, like the one half, because
mm-hmm.
you know that up is symmetric, so the like up down plus down up still has to be symmetric.
So these guys I probably didn't say these are all called triplet states, and this is called the singlet state. And you can see that they're all symmetric under changing the two particles. Well, this one's anti-symmetric. So yeah, you can remember that that's the triplet. And I guess I just want to point out, because we'll come back to this later, you can see that at least one of the triplets and the singlet, they're entangled particles. So what this means is that you can't write them as a tensor product of the state of one particle and the state of the other particle. And you could imagine, let's just put the labels on. So this is particle A, that's particle B, particle A, particle B. And now if I take particle A and particle B and send them to, you know, opposite ends of the universe, if I then make a measurement on particle A, which gives me either the result up or the result down, that's going to project the particle B into either, let's say if I got the result up, projects the particle B into down, and if I get the result down, it projects it into up. So that's going to meet. And this, we'll see this come up later in the lecture. Right. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say about spin. And for the rest of the lecture, I'd like to extend the formalism that we've been dealing with to the density matrix picture. So far, everything's been in the state vector picture or the wave function picture, which only allows you to describe quantum states that are pure. But we'll see that in, the density matrix picture is more general, and we can look at states that are interacting with other states, and we can describe ensembles of quantum states using this picture. Okay, so the density matrix picture becomes really convenient when you want to deal with ensembles of quantum states. So suppose that you've got a quantum state that's in one of a number of these states. So it'll be in one of these psi I states, where I is some index that distinguishes between these states. And the probability that it is in one of these states, I will call P of I. And then both of those two objects together, I can say, define the ensemble from which I'm going to be selecting these quantum states. So we'll say ensemble. Okay, so the density matrix or density operator, I'm going to use these two terms interchangeably as it is, as people do in the literature. So let's say density operator, or you can say matrix. Even though, I mean, so formally they're different things, because this thing is an operator, and it can have a matrix representation, like we saw with these Pauli matrices. They're the matrix representation of the Pauli operator. But people do tend to just switch the words around. So the density operator is defined as the sum over the outer product of all of these states in this ensemble. And so for the density operator to describe an actual physical state, it needs to satisfy a few properties. So rho must satisfy So for starters, you need the trace of rho to be equal to 1. And this is just to say that all of the probabilities of the outcomes are going to be add up to 1. We also require that that it's positive semi-definite. Which means that it has non-negative eigenvalues. And we require that it's Hermitian. Which means that its complex conjugate is equal to itself. And so both of these ensure that the expectation values of operators give you real numbers. So if, let's say if we have a density matrix rho that is simply written as an outer product of one particular state, we say that that's a pure state. And if it can't be written like this, then we say that it's a mixed state. And so there's a criterion for calculating, for determining whether a state is pure or not, and that's called the purity. So the purity is given by the trace of rho squared. And so you can see that if rho is equal to just the outer product of a state psi, and then we multiply that by itself, then you're going to get an inner product that goes to zero, and you'll just get rho again. And then we know that trace rho is equal to one. So of course, if trace rho squared equals one, then it's pure. And if trace rho squared is less than one, then we say that it's mixed. And I'm gonna, I didn't write
sorry.
This down, but I think, sorry.
But the state is whether it is pure, no?
The state that I've written is pure.
Okay.
But let's say if I had a state that was psi 1 plus psi 2, then now if you took that state and then multiplied it by itself, you would find, well, we can just do it. Well, it depends. So if psi 1 and psi 2 are orthogonal, you're going to get a half. If they're not orthogonal, which I mean, they don't have to be.
To be normal.
Do you need
to be pardon me?
Because otherwise the probabilities add up to more than 1.
To make the trace be 1.
Didn't normalize your rho.
Oh, I didn't. Okay, you want to half it. Yeah, but you don't know. Like maybe this thing is defined in a way that's that it's unnormalized. I didn't specify what it is.
You can absorb the numerical.
Right. And I didn't even say that they're orthogonal. So maybe I should have called them phis, so that we're not getting confused with that. But I could definitely, like, I mean, I don't have to have this orthogonal decomposition. I could have it being, you know, two non-orthogonal states. Okay, so I think it might actually take too long to figure this out. And we'll do an example a bit later on anyway, a specific example. But the point is that you're not going to, like, you'll get things like the inner products of phi 1 and phi 2 that are going to be, I mean, it'll depend on what the form of phi is, but it's not going to necessarily give you something that's equal to 1 in the end. Or at least rho squared is not necessarily going to be equal to rho if it's not written just like this, so having one term in this sum. Okay, so a couple of other comments. So sometimes it's tempting to assign some sort of special significance to the eigenstates of the density matrix or the density operator. So let's take, for example, a state. So it'll be, let's say, a spin state, a half spin half particle. So it's written in this mixed state like that. You might want to think that this really represents something that that is spin up with probability 3/2. That can't be right. They don't add up. That's better. You might think this represents a particle that's definitely in the up position at probability 3/4 and in the down position with the probability 1/4. But it's not necessarily true, because I could, let's say, define a different basis. So let's say I call A the square root of 3/4 up plus 1/4 down. And then B is the same, but with a different phase. If I define a basis like this, I can write down rho So let's say I construct some sort of state that's a equal superposition of these two states. And something you're going to show in the tutorial is that this thing is exactly equal to the thing that I've written down here. So you can see that ensembles of very different states. So this one is an equal ensemble of the states A and B, and this one is an unequal ensemble of the states up and down. So different states, ensembles, can give you the same density matrix. So you have to be very careful about how to interpret what a density matrix actually means.
When you define your ensembles, just a probability distribution with some sort of states that, that we are choosing to be orthonormal?
So in this decomposition, they're going to be orthonormals.
Yeah, but
orthonormal states.
But there is no need to do it, or is
there's no need to do what?
Be orthonormal.
It's an
issue, yeah.
So you can always.
Yeah.
You can always do shit.
Right, okay.
Make stuff.
So I can always write it as
I mean, you can write whatever you like.
So
I could write a state that's
like
that's some alpha plus beta A. I mean, I can write that down, and that's a density matrix. Yeah. But I can always find some sort of basis where it can be decomposed into an orthonormal set. Okay. Yes.
In this case, wouldn't the naive interpretation give the same result? Because like the naive interpretation that state on the right board row is a probability of 1/2 that I'll have the state A. And a probability of 1/2 I'll have the state
yeah.
B.
So your interpretation won't change the results of your experiments at all, but it can lead to faults in logic like later on down the track. So maybe if we get to the end and I talk about entangled particles and reduced density matrices, then it might become clear that the density matrix doesn't have to represent something that's constructed from an ensemble, but it can be used to represent, let's say, a subsystem of some composite system. And there, it doesn't even really make sense to think about like what the ensemble that I'm choosing from is. It's just a nice way to, I guess, motivate the density matrix picture. Does that answer your question? Or not? Sort of. Do you want to repeat it? Maybe I.
No, well, I guess it's just that, I mean, my question is I don't see how naive interpretation breaks down when you change your basis. And the answer, I guess, is that you'll see how it breaks down later.
Well, I mean, the point is that you shouldn't, like classically, let's say if spin up and spin down was like a coin flip or whatever, well, I mean, you would say that it really is just a classical mixture of these two things. But here, if you can interpret it as a mixture of two very different states, then you can't really make a statement about what it really is. Like, I mean, you can, how should I say it?
Like in the up-down representation, those are sort of pure states in a way, whereas like
well,
A and B represent a superposition of...
No, but they're pure still. So if you work out the purity, it's going to be 1.
Where?
So the purity of A is 1. So it's nothing to do with purity.
I didn't mean
it's
pure in the...
Right, but I could also write this guy. I can write this state plus as some sort of superposition of A and B. So there's nothing intrinsically different about those states.
Yeah.
So you, Jacob, did you have your hand up? No?
I was going to
say... Oh, sorry.
I was going to say, I mean, the coefficients are different, so I don't see anything wrong with saying that the probability is 3/4 up and 1/4 down, or 1/2 A or 1/2 B.
You can say if I measure in this basis, I'm
yeah.
going to get results 1/2 and 1/2.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I measure in this basis, I'm going to get results 3/4 and 1/4.
So
but you shouldn't say,
that?
Well, that's different. So what I said is different to what you said. You said the probability that the state is in this state with probability 1/2, and this is in that state with probability 1/2. And interpretation, I mean, they're different statements. Mine's a statement about the results of measurements. Yours is a statement about reality.
Well,
and it's, And so
reality is only realized with the measurement.
Yeah, so the point is that here you've got a density matrix that could correspond to two different realities, I guess, if you want to think about these probabilities described.
But what reality would have more meaning if a measurement wasn't made?
That's true. But you just have to... But this, I mean, this sort of stuff leads, like thinking this way leads to... bad things down the track. I mean, you see people doing bad things with this sort of thinking. So I just want to stress caution.
Pointless question to ask if the moon's there when I'm not.
Yeah, no, you've said this. We know. Okay. I really want to get to. Well, I'm gonna. If David got to go over, I'm gonna go over as well. I want to say a couple more things. Just a few very brief statements about evolution and measurement. And these are just very natural extensions of evolution and measurement in the state vector picture. Okay, so evolution is... Well, unitary evolution. So a density matrix is a function of time, is going to evolve according to a unitary operator. And so it's kind of obvious to see that that's true if you think about this as just being a pure state. So then... for a pure state, you would have U of T on psi 0 and then, well, this thing here is just going to be the standard psi of T that you would be familiar with, and this thing is its complex conjugate. But this thing applies to even, you know, not pure density matrices. And measurement. Is also quite analogous. So let's say we have a measurement that's given by a set of measurement operators. Let's call them M subscript M. Then the probability of getting outcome M is going to be given by the trace of the measurement operator, its complex conjugate itself, and the density matrix, and then the state rho m after we make the measurement. So you can convince yourself that this is at least plausible if you, for the density matrix, insert a pure state and do the same thing here. This will just give you the same thing that you're used to for pure states. And just to finish off, I wanted to tell you about the reduced density operator, which is a very, very, very important operator, a very important tool, especially in quantum computing and quantum information theory. But also in disciplines where people are looking at the quantum to classical transition and decoherence and things like that. Okay, so suppose you've got two physical systems, A and B, and then I can write down the density matrix that describes these two systems, just as A, rho subscript A and B. And but it's plausible to think about only being interested in what happens to one of these subsystems. Let's say you don't have access to this other guy. So let's say we had like the state that I was talking about before, the triplet state that I send off the two electrons to either sides of the universe. I can only have access to one guy. So how would we describe the quantum state of just this subsystem A? Well, we do this by figuring out the reduced density matrix, which is defined in terms of the partial trace. Oops, oh, sorry. Okay, so if we want to write down the density matrix for system A, we're going to have subsystem A is equal to the partial trace. We say partial trace over the system B of the composite density matrix. And so we can define the partial trace in a very simple way. So we can define it for pure states. Sorry, not for pure states, but for density matrix elements. So if you have something like trace over B of something that looks like that,
what's the thing in the middle?
That is a tensor product, which we've been using here. Well, at least when we were talking about singlet states, we were using implicitly. But it's defined just the same as a tensor product for actual matrices or vectors. And it tells us that this thing refers to subsystem A and this thing refers to subsystem B. So something like that is going to be equal to A1, A2, times just the standard trace of the B system. So that's defined just for one density matrix element, but you can extend this very easily just by using the linear properties of the trace. And we'll see this in the example that I'll give you in a second.
So it's sort of like it's the identity for A.
It's what? The identity?
Identity for A tensor product. Measure and trace.
Identity for, what are you talking about this?
A stays the same.
No, A1
oh, yeah,
A2
yeah.
Aren't the same states. So, they're
not the same states. It's just an element of a density matrix.
No, I meant
the same as what's on the left. It doesn't do anything.
It doesn't.
I meant there's part
yeah,
of the
okay.
trace.
Yeah, okay. So, what it means is do nothing to system A and do the trace on system B.
Yeah.
But not like a real trace. So, I mean, at least if you just take out the one element of the entire density matrix, it means take the trace of system B. And because the trace is just the standard trace, we can write this like this. So it'll be the inner product of these two elements. Okay, so just to finish off, I want to give you an example, and that's to do with the thing that I was just mentioning here. So let's say we've got, are we doing triplet or single? Okay, let's say we've got the entangled triplet state, and we send off the electrons to either sides of the universe. Then how are we going to describe just the subsystem of electron A? So entangled triplet state. So we can write the density matrix of A and B is just going to be the outer product of the triplet state, which I've written in the total angular momentum representation. And then I can rewrite this in terms of the basis of the composite systems, and that'll be that. So I've just inserted, do we still have it written somewhere? Yeah, so I've just, the second one here, the plus up, whatever, it'll be in the notes. But in any case, I've just inserted the definition of this guy and then expanded out so you can see that you get four terms. And so let me just change boards to do the reduced density operator. So then row A is the trace of row A B, which, so using the linearity of the trace, we can write this as trace of B of this.
So if you were to write this out in tensor notation, you're basically contracting out the indices.
So you could write this thing here. It's going to be. So that kind of makes it clearer that you've split it up into two separate subsystems, but I mean they're equivalent. And I mean we'll get to that step in a sec. I'm almost done. This is just the last thing that I wanted to do. So all I've done here is just applied the partial trace to each of the elements of that thing, so using the linearity of the trace. And now I'm going to kind of skip a step because I'll rewrite this thing in terms of that. And then because we're tracing out subsystem B, we saw that the trick that you do is you just move this guy over to that side, and then you've got an inner product between the two. So that'll be equal to... So all I've done is just, like I said, swap these guys over. And now we can evaluate these inner products. So the inner product of that is going to be equal to 1. Inner product of that is 0 because they're orthogonal states. Inner product of that is 0. Inner product of that is 1. And so that means that these two middle terms go to 0. And we're just left with something like this. And so you can convince yourself, if you calculate the purity of the state, it's going to be purity half, which means it's a maximally mixed state. You can also see that it's equal to the identity, proportional to the identity. So whenever a state is proportional to the identity, it's maximally mixed. So this is like really, really cool and really interesting that the composite system of two particles can be a completely known, well-defined pure state. And then if you just look at the properties of one subsystem, there's just nothing that you can know about it. It's completely mixed. And so people use these sorts of arguments to think about the quantum classical transition, saying that, when a state is mixed, it means that it doesn't have any off-diagonal elements and it doesn't have coherences or coherent superpositions between the states. So you can kind of think about quantum particles entangling with everything else in the universe, and then because you're only ever looking at just a subsystem of the universe, because of this original entanglement, when you, I guess, think about doing the reduced density, figuring out the reduced density matrix of the system that you're looking at, you'll get something that looks kind of classical and that has this interpretation in terms of classical statistical probabilities. Okay, so that's kind of all I wanted to say about that. I guess I'll see you guys at the tutorial in a bit. No questions?